This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca. You might have noticed, newspapers, TV stations, and other news outlets are dropping like flies in Canada these days. Whoops, there goes another one. But that's okay, because it leaves more room for independent media, like Rabble.ca. You can join the independent media revolution too. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate.
I got a little bit of a hint from the prosecutor's office and say, you will be convicted no matter what. But he said, don't worry about numbers of years, not important. As I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, after your conviction, it's all depend on the attitude of United States governments. And how they deal with your case will determine what's going to happen to you.
You're listening to The Hum.
Glad Cohen here with The Hum Podcast, joined by my co-host today, very special co-host, Katie Swales, who's our podcast co-producer and editor.
Very glad to be here.
So stoked you're here. And we're joined here today by a very special guest who spent, is it right, 735 days in a labor camp in North Korea.
That's correct.
Kenneth Bay. So my first question would be, how does it feel to be the most dangerous American that North Korea has seen since the Korean War?
When North Korean authority told me that, I didn't know what to make of it, because not only I was trying to do mission work in North Korea, but I encouraged and mobilized people around the world to go to North Korea, do the work of mission work, and therefore they said that we have to label you as one of the most dangerous, the worst criminal we ever apprehended in our history.
Wow.
And Kenneth, what was the crime that they were alleging you had done?
Well, they charged me with two counts. One is they said I was trying to overthrow the government through two things. One is prayer, and the other one is worship. Which means taking people into North Korea as tourists, but having them to pray and worship in North Korea, they found it very threatening. So they said, we have to charge you because you're trying to overthrow the government through the prayer and worship.
Just to be clear, you weren't handing Bibles to people or really trying to convert anyone. You were just simply bringing people into the country to pray.
That's right. You know, all the work they involved, that I brought about 300 people into North Korea just to walk around and meet the people and pray and love the people over there. And they still thought that it was very threatening.
So you've got a book out. It's called Not Forgotten, The True Story of My Imprisonment in North Korea. And on the back of the book, I'm just going to read something really quick. It says, as the black sedan rolled up in front of the hotel, I knew this was it. Two men in dark suits emerged from the car. One man asked, are you Mr. Bay? Yes, I said. You need to come with us. What happened next?
Well, I was walking around the parking lot of the hotel, and then the car pulled over, and two men came out.
Which city are you in?
And this is a city called Rajin. And this is northeast corner of North Korea. And then they just came out and they said, you need to come with us. And I hesitated for a moment, but they reinforced in a way that is, you need to come. So I got in the car, and then car drove up and took me to a remote location. It was one of the hotel hidden in the back of the mountainside. And then from there, I spent about a month being investigated before I was taken to Pyongyang for an indictment to happen from there.
It's a really interesting quote, because you say, I knew this was it. Mm-hmm. Why did you know something was it? What had happened?
Because earlier that day, as usual, I brought people into North Korea as a tourist. But this time it was different, because I accidentally brought in external computer hard drive into the countries that contains some Western media covering, some footage covering North Korea. And they did offend them, because there were some sensitive material about North Korea they didn't like for people to see. And therefore, they confiscated my hard drive. But they let me go on with my tour. So I was very nervous. Not only they found those clips, but on this hard drive contain all my mission work report and newsletters and photos and video clips of my work in China and North Korea was in there. So I knew that once they discover those, they will come for me.
This is just so insane, right? It's not every day that we get to sit with someone who is going through this very experience. So let's go to the hotel. Mm-hmm. They take you into the hotel. You must be so nervous.
Yes, I was nervous. I didn't know what was going to happen next. And usually when I hear this kind of report before, it doesn't turn out that great. So right. Therefore, I was just waiting to find out, anxious to find out what's going to happen to me. And then to the people I brought in, and I was starting to panic from there.
So you said you endured about a month of investigation, interrogation. Can you tell us a little bit about what that actually entailed?
Is it as bad as we think?
Well, it was extremely difficult to endure during those 4 weeks that I have to go through. I usually start from like early morning, maybe 7 or 8 in the morning, until 10 or 11 o'clock in night. I had to write whatever they asked me to confess. And then it doesn't work, and they don't like the answer that I was writing.
Was it honest?
In the beginning, there are a couple of things that I had to do. One is I need to protect the people who came in, and also that the work that I was involved in China and North Korea, I wanted to make sure that everybody else who were involved with me, they will have some time for them to be able to find out what was happening to me. So in the beginning, I only give out the limited answer to whatever the question they were asking. So instead of volunteering for information, I just waited as long as I could so that the people that were involved in our ministry and our network will be able to inform and they will be able to find a safe route.
Right. Walk me through a little bit about the actual experience. Like, who was the guy? Was it one guy that was investigating? Were there several people? Did he have a sense of humor? Were you able to get along with him?
Well, I didn't think he had a sense of humor at all.
No?
There were about three or four people involved in doing investigation, but there was one main guy. I later on found out his name is Mr. Park, and he's a guy about maybe late 30s, early 40s. He's just a very short, really skinny guy, but he's been an investigator for a while. That's what he told me. And then pretty much in the morning until at night, he come in and ask questions and then ask me to write it down, the answer, and go back and forth for all day long. And obviously, most of the time, he didn't like the answer that was given because I was telling them is, I brought the hard drive as accident, not purposely. It was just an honest mistake. I didn't mean anything harm. I didn't want to cause any trouble. But they didn't take that for answer. They pretty much just say, you're lying. You know, we don't believe you. And the more time go by, they start discovering more things about me and my involvement as a mission work, as a missionaries. And so I have to later on to confess that, yes, I'm a missionary. And I brought people here to pray and worship. I love the people. And then from that moment on, things went really, really difficult because they started to see me as someone was sent by U.S. government to tear down their country or something like that.
So now it's getting way, way worse.
Yeah, it was worse than it was. First, it was just about video clips that I brought in. Later on, they thought that there was somebody behind the scene that orchestrating all these things.
Mm.
And they've been asking, who sent you? You know, who's behind you? And I say, God.
Right.
I'm just a missionary. And I'm not. And then they say, you know, there got to be somebody above you. And they later on found out that I was working with the Youth with Missions.
Youth with a Mission, YWAM.
YWAM. And then I was sent from Kona, Hawaii. And this is where the founder of Youth with Mission, Lorraine Cunningham, is. And then they say, above you is Lorraine Cunningham. And above Lorraine Cunningham is President Obama. Because President Obama told Lorraine to send you to terrorize our country by injecting the Christian virus into the countries.
And for those who don't know, I mean, saying God to the common North Korean person is not, it's not something that they're very aware of, right? North Korea is a country where most people don't believe in a religion.
You know, in about 100 years ago, North Korea, especially capital city of Pyongyang, is known to be, it was known as Jerusalem of the Far East. There are more Christians living in that city than any other city in Asia at the time. Mm. So there are more churches there than any other places. But now people living there, they have no idea what it's like to live outside. They have no access to outside. Therefore, they never heard about anything special about religion from outside. So one person asked me very sincerely this question. I heard about God before, but never heard about Jesus before. So where does Jesus live, in China or North Korea?
He's in Toronto, actually. And everywhere.
And therefore, and I thought I was just kidding, but he was very sincerely asking.
Right.
But this is what North Korea is like. They never even heard the name Jesus before. This is something we take it for granted every day, but over there, it's just something new.
So this whole process goes on for about a month.
Yes.
In this hotel. And for our listeners who probably already know, North Korea is very closed off. So while you're there, do you have any idea of what's happening with the rest of the world? Do you have any inkling that the rest of the world's wondering where you are? Does anyone know that you're going through this process as you're going through it?
No, I didn't think that anybody outside knew what I was going through, because I was just taken from, you know, I was walking by myself. Another person was walking with me, but not from our tour group. Therefore, people didn't know what happened to me. And then once I figured it out that my tour group left the country, I hope that someone from other side either contacted U.S. governments or at least my family members, and so that informed them what was happening. But later I found out they had no idea really what was happening to me at the time, especially for about 4 weeks. They thought that I would be coming home in a couple of weeks. That's what the North Korean government informed the rest of the group, that I'll be home soon, and they'd send them off. And so my wife was actually waiting just patiently, just hoping that, you know, I'll come home anytime. But for 4 weeks that she never heard anything from, you know, my side or anything like that.
But you were also worried about your wife and your family and mm-hmm. your assistant and people who you work with. What was that like, having absolutely no way of communicating with them, but, you know, being completely isolated and worrying about their safety?
Yeah, I was really, I was worried about more about my family and people involved in my ministry more than myself, because I thought because of my careless mistake, now I'm putting, you know, many people in danger. But there was a moment, you know, like a third day of my detainment. So, you know, they made me stand on the middle of the room all day long without moving. So, and I was standing for hours, so 6 or 7 hours at least. And then I just had a kind of like a supernatural experience with God. And it's almost like I feel like he's saying that is, no one will be harmed through this, and I'm with you. Do not worry about anything else. So I was holding on to the promise that no one will be harmed, so I was hoping everybody will be okay, and not only my family members, but other people involved in the ministry. After a few months later, I found out everybody was fine. And then when I came home, all the people involved in ministry were kept safe, because I found, just like the God promised, no one was harmed through this. There were, could be a disaster for many people,
right.
But everybody kept safe.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole thing ends in the hotel room. Mm-hmm. And now let's go forward a bit. So was there a fair trial? Were you assigned a lawyer? How long did that whole process go through? Because I know that eventually you were convicted mm-hmm. and charged with 15 years of hard labor. Right? So
yeah.
Did you ever think you had a fair chance?
Well, from the city of Rajin, I was taken to Pyongyang, and then when they got there, they informed me that I'm going to be tried, and then most likely I'll receive either death penalty or life in prison. And when I heard that, it was just very unreal, because I thought that I'll be actually released by cooperating with them, but later, rather, they're going to put me on the stand. So it took about a 4.5 months waiting and doing more, verifying everything before the actual trial happened. The trial happened in end of April 2013. I received 15 years of sentence. So actually, I was glad to only receive 15 years compared to life or death sentence.
You were glad?
I was glad that at least I didn't, you know, they're not going to go out and shoot me.
That's very positive. I guess to not shoot you.
There were a couple of times they have threatened that they may just skip the trial, just take me out on the square and shoot.
Right,
and,
right.
Because at the time, there were tension between U.S. with North Korea, because that's right after they did a missile launch and third nuclear testing. And there were tension between two countries was really extremely intense. And they just couldn't do anything to U.S., but I'm American in custody, so they took that on me in a way that is, you know, if you don't cooperate, then we can just end it now.
I wanted to touch more upon your time now in the labor camp. Mm-hmm. What was it like?
My day started at 6 in the morning. This is when I wake up. They actually wake me up at 6. And then I get ready and wash up and then have breakfast at 7.
Were you in your own cell?
Yes, I was in my own cell. Turned out that my prison, it was only for foreigners only. And therefore, I didn't see any other inmate. At the time, I was the only prisoner at the camp. And there were about 30-some guards working in the camp. So I received a lot of attention from many people.
It was the Kenneth Bay camp.
So I was staying in the room 3 of the camp. There were about 7 or 8 different rooms. It wasn't really a big facility for where the inmates are supposed to stay. In my room, there's a small bathroom built in, and then there was rooms divided into 2 sections. One is like a living section with a desk and chair and a TV. The other room has another desk and bed in there. So I get up at 6 in the morning, wash up and get ready, have breakfast at 7. They let me keep my Bible. I had my Bible with me.
That's interesting.
I was able to read Bible and pray and just spend time in worship and then get myself ready to go at 8 o'clock. And from 8 to 10, I worked 2 hours at the farm. In the beginning, I was working at the bean field and planting the seed, and later on, in the wintertime, I was shoveling the coal and digging the hole and, you know, just doing many different, like, hard labor, odd jobs. And about a year later, then I was actually, they let me do some carrying rocks and what kind of hard labor supposed to be.
Did you have any days off?
I had a day off on Sunday. So I worked 6 days a week from 8 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock in the evenings. Work 8 hours straight, but there's 2 hours, like one, you know, have two 30-minute break and 1 hour break in
between. 10 hours a day?
10 hours a day, 6 days a week. And then Sunday, I get to rest, but the resting means not sleeping or laying down, but I have to sit in the chair all day and watch their TV, propaganda TV, for all day from 10 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock at night.
You have to.
Yeah. Wow. So I didn't have a choice to do anything else other than sit at the chair, stare at the TV for 12 hours.
My gosh.
Which was worse.
I prefer going to work.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say, I lived in South Korea for 2 years, and that work schedule just reminds me of like a typical South Korean person's work week anyway. 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing here, while you were there, quite a number of things happened. You lost 50 pounds. There was concerns that you were beginning to go blind. Diabetes, high blood pressure, fatty liver, and back problems that you had before. And I'm just going to say this because obviously our viewers can't see you, but you look great today. You look healthy and great. Are you healthy? Are you doing okay?
Well, I'm doing much better. I did lost about closer to 60 pounds or so. And then after I came home, my wife was so glad that I'm home, but she wasn't glad that my weight came back with me. So slowly I've kept, you know, caught up with all the weight that I lost now. So
I understand that you were put in a hospital. You were there for quite a bit. I remember seeing that in the news. Mm-hmm. What was that like? And also, while you were in prison, did you have any opportunities to see anyone, to speak to any family, to send any letters? Was there any opportunity to do anything like that?
Yes. So I was working at the labor camp for about 3 months. And then because of my health issues and lost a lot of weight, they decided to send me to a hospital. I was hospitalized for a few months and then was sent back to labor camp, going back and forth about 3 times. Meanwhile, my family were able to write to me. I was able to write them back. But sometimes it takes about a month or two before I get another letter. But we were able to exchange letters. So that really helped, and knowing that, that I mean, my family is doing everything they can to secure my release, and also that how they're doing was really encouraging me that to stay focused and stay healthy.
And I understand also that your mom, mm-hmm. was she able to...
Yeah, my mom visited me when I was in hospital. After being in the hospital for a couple of months, I recovered quite a bit. I was resting, and suddenly one of the prostitutes came to me and said, "Your mom's here, and she'll be walking into the room."
Just about, like a surprise like that?
Yeah, about 20 minutes.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
So we had a really emotional reunion, as you can imagine. We embraced each other. Apparently, they let my mom come in to show how humanitarian they are in treating the prisoner, even though, you know, I was supposed to be the worst criminal ever.
In history.
Yeah,
it was kind of like a publicity stunt.
I believe so, but it was, you know, I'm grateful because they allowed my mom to come and visit. Mm. So my mom was there for about 3 days. We visited for about 2 hours each day for about 3 days in a row. One amazing thing that happened is that when I was in labor camp, I was hungry, I was tired, so I was thinking about food.
What were you thinking of?
So I had a list of the food that I want to eat. One was Hawaiian chocolate with macadamia nut. Mm. Second thing was Kit Kat.
Kit Kat, just chocolate.
Yeah. Third thing was beef jerky.
Beef jerky.
And beef then
jerky.
Fourth thing was protein bar. And then fifth thing was mixed nut.
Is that no kimchi on this list.
Lots of protein. Yeah.
So these are things, but where can I get, you know, these items, you know, from the North Korean labor camp?
That's the most random list I've ever heard in my life. I did not expect that.
And then when my mom came to visit me, and the second day she said, "I brought you something." She opened her bag, and first thing she took out was Hawaiian chocolate with macadamia nut.
Oh my God.
And the second thing was Kit Kat. Third thing was beef jerky. Fourth thing was protein bar. Fifth thing was mixed nut. It's almost like I called her and asked for those items, but never called, never wrote to her, not even pray for what these items.
I had those five items for you, and Katie told me not to bring them today. I had a feeling.
So in a way, it was a God's reminder that he cared for me, and then he's with me. And there was this way to show that I'm in good hand. Mm. Yeah.
What were you eating in the labor camp?
The food was very simple, mostly soup and rice and some vegetable. In the first year, they actually gave me some egg and a little bit of meat also. But starting from second year, maybe they ran out, or they didn't have budget for it, or they didn't have enough. So I just figured out later on that even prison guard did not have much to share. So therefore, the quantity and the quality of food kind of dropped from the second year.
Were you able to develop any relationships? Because you were the only, you said, prisoner in this, mm-hmm. in this camp. You're spending time with, you said, 30 different guards throughout the day, throughout your time there. Were you able to develop any sort of relationship with these North Korean guards? And maybe were you able to have any sort of honest conversations with them about anything?
Yes. For first year or so, I didn't have much of meaningful conversation with them. They were very tough on me. And then they thought that you're Korean, but you're American. You're working with Americans. They thought that I was CIA. And they thought there was somebody really there to tear down the country. So it was for their attitude kind of show that. But after being there for about 2 or 3, 4 months, they're starting to open up. They kind of see as who I was. And they see that I was missionary and pastor and just there. And they said I was there because of my conviction in God, not anything else. Mm. And so they're starting to open up and more. When we are alone, they will say pastor instead of 103. And then they say, "Hey, can I talk to you?" And they'll talk about the marriage problems and kids problems. And so I was doing like premarital counseling to parenting and different things and talking to them. And they...
We got to talk after.
Yeah. Yeah. They were just... I just kind of see them as they're just real people living this. We had the same problem like we do. And just that they're ordinary people going through the same thing, except only thing different is that they're living in a different system, different countries. And they have to live that way. That's what I was finding out more.
You were talking about watching that TV, and Katie, you asked what was worse. While you were watching that TV, did you at all see anything about Dennis Rodman? Because there was a whole circus happening on this side of the world with Dennis Rodman going over. He tweeted at one point to Kim Jong-un. What was it again?
he wanted Kim Jong-un to do him a solid and release you.
Yeah. Right. And he was going to go there and say, you know, it's not easy, but I'm going to try. Were you aware that any of that was happening? And what are your thoughts now that you're out on that whole thing?
Well, I wasn't aware of anything, but maybe Kim Jong-un has his personal Twitter account they check every week.
Kim Jong number un.
Yeah. But this is when it was 2014, I believe. 2014, January. I was actually in hospital just watching TV. And one evening, I saw Dennis Rodman on TV. And he was there with ex-NBA players. And he had an exhibition game with the North Korean athletes. And then he sang a birthday song to Kim Jong-un. And also, it was unreal to see him there. But I was hoping that maybe, if he's so close, then if he knows I'm in custody, so maybe something can come out from it. But in a couple of weeks later, prosecutor came to see me and very, very upset, telling me that Western media coverage about my case is getting worse. And so what do you mean by that is when Dennis Rodman came, he apparently did an interview with CNN.
Yep.
And then turned out he was a little drunk and he kind of rambled. Yep. And then he kind of told the CNN crew that I pretty much deserve to be there. And they created a media frenzies and people were talking about me being held as innocent. So North Korean governments say, what are you going to do about this? I said, what can I do about it? Then finally I agreed that maybe then I'll do a press conference admitting that I'm guilty. I apologize one more time. Ask for mercy and asking U.S. government to do everything they can. Would that please you? Then would you let me go home? That was my suggestion. And then they put me on the press conference. Yep. After the press conference was over, they actually sent me to a labor camp just to make sure that people know that they're in business. But one thing that out of that is they said, when you talk about your statement, do not mention anything about Dennis Rodman. Leave him out of it.
Right. Good idea, as a general rule.
Because here's a special relationship with Kim Jong-un. They wanted to make sure that anything negative about Dennis Rodman is not good for them.
So you talk about in your book, when you were in the hotel, you had a kind of a daydream about Barack Obama giving an order to have Marines or to have a special envoy come and rescue you. Mm-hmm. Were you aware at any point that, you know, he was talking about your case, that he was trying to have somebody come to North Korea and ask for you to be released? What were you aware of about what was happening and who was trying to figure out how to get you out?
Not until about a year later. That's the when my sister wrote to me that she's doing everything possible. She visited the White House. She visited State Department, met with Secretary Kerry. And so I knew the U.S. government was working in behalf and then trying to get me released. But I didn't know what the president said until I got home. I was just very, very surprised, and I was very grateful to know that the U.S. government was trying their best to get me home, regardless of delay of a timing issue. But I believe there was a timing issue rather than anything else. But they were sincere and they were trying their best. There were a few attempts by U.S. governments trying to get me home those 2 year period of time, even though they weren't successful.
And that's really interesting because Pastor Lim, mm-hmm. who is a Mississauga man from just outside Toronto, currently being held in what we know is the same labor camp and possibly even the very cell that you stayed in. He's been there for 15 months. What do you think that the Canadian government should be doing to try to help Pastor Lim?
You know, based on my experience, I do believe that, because now Pastor Lim's already convicted, he was sent to labor camp, he's serving life sentence. And therefore, only way he'll be able to go home is receive a special pardon from Kim Jong-un himself, just like I received. Therefore, that means that government-level talk need to be arranged in order for any progress is to made. So far, my understanding is Pastor Lim received a couple of counselor visits from the Canadian embassy in South Korea. But as far as I know, no higher level official visited them or trying to negotiate for his release yet. So I do believe that now is time for more action. The fact that they have put Pastor Lim's on the stage on CNN, it can give indication that the North Korean government is willing to talk. And then the family members are really asking the Canadian government to really step in and take action, because more they wait, it'll be very difficult for Pastor Lim to recover. And even if he come back, then I think it'll be very difficult for him to readjust everything.
I want to go back to your day of release. Mm-hmm. What happened? Did you know that you were being released ahead of time? How were you told? And what was it like to get out?
You know, the night before I was released, which was November 7th, 2014, later in the night, the prosecutor came to see me and say, you have an interview tomorrow with the Western media, so get ready for it. But normally he doesn't visit me that late at night. So I asked, did somebody from U.S. government come? And then he said, no. He pretty much just said, just another interview. But do this well, maybe this is the last one you need to do. And the next day, 7:30 in the morning, he came to take me to the one location in a hotel, and I was transferred there. I waited a little bit, and then that one doctor and two American officials came in the door and told me that they're just there to check up my health. And they spent about 15, 20 minutes, and they say, good luck to you, sir, and they left. So I had no idea what was happening. So I was waiting from 9 in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, sitting alone in the room. And then 3 o'clock, the prosecutor came back and said, let's go. You know, I couldn't say anything, so I just followed him. I thought I was going back to labor camp. And then the car door opened, and I found myself in front of the Korea Hotel, which was the largest hotel in the city. They took me up to second floor. This is when I found out that, you know, I was actually being pardoned by Kim Jong-un himself. So that was around 3:15. They asked me to write another confession and apology letter to Kim Jong-un himself. And then 3:30, I was taken into another big, larger room. A few minutes later, American delegation came in and sat. And then a few minutes later, a one-star general walked into the room shouting everybody to stand up. And then four-star general came into the room. He is a director of National Security Bureau, the one who was responsible for Kim Jong-un's uncle's death, Jang Chang-taek. Mm-hmm. He walked in, probably meanest-looking guy ever that I saw. And he had this declaration from the Kim Jong-un himself, is that hereby to, you know, give a special pardon for American criminal Kenneth Bae. Oh. And it was signed by Kim Jong-un. And then after that, they hand me over to U.S. delegation. And then I arrived at the airport around 4 o'clock. And then we left after that. So I had no idea. Turned out that even American envoy did not know until the last minute that they were able to take us home.
What was it like going home, getting out of there, seeing your family, and knowing that you were now safe?
When they took us to the airport, the bus did not stop at the front of the airport. They went into the all the way into the runway and saw the big plane, say, you know, the United States of America. That's the when I finally realized that I'm going home. And then I got on board, and we flew out for a couple of hours, and then they said, you know, the meal was served. It was a grilled cheese sandwich with a French onion soup.
And how was it?
It was wasn't so good. A
Kit Kat. It was like a taste of America, you know, finally say, wow, I'm with a bunch of Americans. They came all the way here to get me. Now I'm finally going home. When we arrived in Seattle, I saw my mom walking toward me. I just embraced her, and then my sister and my rest of the family came after. Just such a, you know, just a joyful and just grateful moment that after 735 days, I'm finally free. And, you know, freedom is such a something that I never appreciated as much. But because my freedom was taken away for 735 days, because of that, I have more heart and more compassion for those people who live without freedom in daily lives. And this is when I realized that my 735 day compared to people in North Korea living day to day for entire their life as a prisoner of their own system, I was able to have more compassion, and I was able to see that is we need to remember these people.
I'm so glad that you brought up the North Korean people, because I think that's why I got involved in this work. That's what also got you involved in the work. Do you have a message for the people of North Korea?
When I was in North Korea, I received letters from the people around the world, and they were saying that is, Kenneth, you are not forgotten. We are standing with you. We're praying for you. You'll be free. You'll be coming home soon. So my message to the people in North Korea and the people who are listening is that we need to remember the people in North Korea, and they need to know that the people outside care. We need to stand with them and remember them so that, you know, we can say someday that when we see them face to face is that you matter to us too. And this is a message that we need to carry, because if we don't care, then no one cares for them.
You've said that you hope you can go back to North Korea someday. Why would you want to go back?
If I go back and others to be able to be going back and forth, more interchange that happened between North Koreans and outside world will bring some sort of closeness and harmony, and they will be able to have more understanding, broader perspective of life, even though we live in such a different societies. If I can be that bridge, then that was my calling and desire, and that desire and calling has not changed yet, even I come home after being detained for such a long time.
You've got such an incredible story, and there's so much more to learn. I just have one final question. That grilled cheese sandwich, was it the best grilled cheese sandwich you ever had?
Well, definitely. It wasn't just a grilled cheese sandwich. It was just taste of home, you know, taste of America. And he's just saying that, wow, now I'm going home.